May it please the court. The question in this case is whether what was intended to be a sword to protect the victims of child abuse and neglect will be flipped and turned into a shield to protect the perpetrators of abuse and neglect. The remedial purpose of the abuse and neglect statutes, the language of the statutes, and the legislature's intent all say that these statutes will continue to protect children.
The Southern District, in its opinion, didn't necessarily agree with that assessment, did it?
No.
As to what the purpose was, and what was the purpose that they thought these limitations also served?
I think the Western District opinion actually is more explicit on that point and relied on the Pitts against Williams case to hold that these statutes also were intended to protect alleged perpetrators. The reliance on Pitts against Williams is incorrect, Your Honor, because in that case, the perpetrator was at the review board hearing stage. This case is at the investigation stage. In the investigation process, in administrative investigations, due process does not apply. It applies at the hearing before the review board stage.
You cite Artman for that, but doesn't Artman say that the type of process that is due depends on the setting in which you are, and that you're not entitled to the same due process before the administrative board? But it doesn't say due process does not apply.
I believe it says due process does not impinge upon administrative investigation.
So, for instance, where the board gave Artman notice of the hearing and allowed him to have his attorney present, its withholding of information about specific complaints and potential areas of inquiry did not violate the due process clause. And at another place it talks about where it's not an adjudication, the agency need not provide the full panoply of judicial procedures. It doesn't say no.
Well, I agree that due process varies from context to context, but the context is same here. In addition, the two U.S. Supreme Court cases that Artman relies upon do say that due process does not implicate, is not implicated in administrative
investigations. Does your argument depend on this court holding that you have absolutely no due process rights at the investigative stage, or do you have an argument also that regardless, due process was complied with here?
Well, the Frye case, there was no due process issue. It's only in the second case. It just doesn't apply at that stage, Your Honor. What would be the process that would apply? It's never been identified. It was not identified in the Court of Appeals opinions. It has not been identified by any alleged perpetrator. So we do not know what process it would be, even.
Well, but are you conflating different questions? One is, what does the statute require? And if the statute is not complied with, then what is the result? Is it required dismissal, or is there some other? Is the lack of a sanction listed in the statute mean it's merely directory? That's very different than the due process issue. Could you address that issue, please?
There are two different issues, of course, and they are distinct. The time limits to conclude investigations and to notify alleged perpetrators after receipt of reports of abuse and neglect are directory, they're hortatory, they're aspirational, they're not mandatory. The 30-day limit to conclude an investigation is not mandatory because there's an explicit exception, good cause to investigate further. If the 30-day requirement were mandatory, there would be no exception, especially an explicit one.
But the fact that there is an exception seems to indicate the intent of the legislature that you're required to comply with it unless you fit within the exception.
Well, it's the intent of the legislature is not mandatory but aspirational. It's the intent of the legislature to encourage the investigators.
Where in the statute does it say that they're aspirational?
It doesn't say that. It does not say that it's mandatory either. It does not use either one of those words.
The 30-day statute talks about unless a good cause for the failure to complete the investigation is documented in the information system. Was it documented in this first case?
Yes, it was. It was documented four times, two times before the 30th day and two times after the 30th day, and then at the date that the determination was made.
But the trial court didn't find good cause?
The trial court made no finding on good cause, probably because it believed that because the decision was made on the 100th day, all it had to address was the 90th day.
Did you show good cause? What was your good cause for taking it to 100 days and not 90?
Two things. Police reports and medical records had not yet been obtained.
Did you bring that to the attention of the court before the 90 days?
Pardon me?
Did you bring that to the attention of the court before the 90 days?
Well, we're at the investigation stage, so
there's no case yet.
There's no court case yet. It was entered into the information system. The alleged perpetrator was informed that there was going to be a delay beyond 30 days. And then the alleged perpetrator needed to be interviewed yet. She had been informed that her husband was subject of an investigation and she would be interviewed about that. And then she'd been informed that she was the subject of a separate investigation and she needed to be interviewed about that.
But so the interviews would be done by your staff in 90 days, so they knew it was 90 days. Why did it take an extra 10 days? Was it because the police report didn't come in until then, or did they make attempts to get it? What was the good cause? Did they show the court at some point that they had good cause, or at the 100th day?
Well, the good cause is to go beyond 30 days, and that was entered into the information system twice before the 30th day.
But the 90-day statute has no good cause exception.
It doesn't.
So how do we harmonize these two statutes, one without the good cause and one with it?
The 90-day limit to notify, this is a notice statute, the 90-day. The 90-day limit to notify the alleged perpetrator of, quote, any determination isn't mandatory because these statutes are remedial statutes. They're construed to provide a remedy for the problem they address. This means the statutes are to be construed in favor of the child so long as it would be consistent with the statutory language.
But why would the legislature put a 90-day time limit in if they didn't mean it?
Because of the two words, any determination. A directory construction of that 90-day limit is consistent with the statutory language of notifying the alleged perpetrator of any determination. That means a determination that has been made. What the statute
says.
Why
did they put the 90 days in at all?
What the statute says is notify of any determination. That is a statute that has been made.
But the legislature intended there to be some time limit or time at which it should be done. Why would they have done that?
Well, they haven't indicated a specific drop-dead deadline.
In your brief, you rely on Farmers and Merchants Bank, which says that courts have concluded, that was the decision of this court that said that statutes directing the performance of an act by a public official within a specified time normally are directory, not mandatory, and the setting of a time limit does little more than establish a time after which an action for mandamus will lie to it. In this particular case, it was a tax case against the director. Is that your argument here?
Well, usually time limit statutes are directory, hortatory, aspirational, and yes, that's part of the argument.
But if you don't know there's an investigation, when would you know when to file a writ?
A writ can be filed after the 30th day or after the 90th day. The writ can be filed at any time if one thinks one should.
But the writ that make them follow the timetable, they wouldn't even know to even file a writ if there was no notification of the investigation.
Well, the alleged perpetrator can count to 30 days, can count to 90 days.
Counsel, the alleged perpetrator was notified of the complaint early, correct?
Yes.
That's statutory as well.
Yes.
So there was no question that that Ms. Fry knew that there had been a complaint, knew that she was the target of the complaint, and knew that there was an investigation.
Oh, yes.
Under the 90-day section, the phrase you're looking at, any determination, if that had said the determination, would the argument that there was a mandatory, not directory, time limit be stronger?
I don't think so. The determination means a determination. Any determination means a determination. But when a determination has not been made for good cause after that 90th day, the statute doesn't say, like some statutes do, that an unconcluded investigation must cease and the report be dismissed, or that the decision shall by operation of law be in favor of the alleged perpetrator, or some other language that indicates the 90 days is a hard and fast deadline. Moreover, construing the 90-day limit to protect the alleged perpetrator sets the legislative purpose on its head. This court said in Jameson that the purpose of these statutes is to protect children. And in some cases, investigations need to take longer than 90 days to protect children. The legislature could not have intended that alleged perpetrators would be exonerated by the mere passage of time, without regard to whether reports are complete, whether good cause to investigate further exists, regardless of the merits of the reports and the safety of children, and whether the perpetrators would be prejudiced by
there was no procedure by which the agency couldn't have asked for an extension of time. The 90 days is in the statute, 90 days. It wasn't, well, the investigation is going to take more time. We need more time to do it. There was no procedure for doing that.
No, there's no one to ask permission to. We're still at the investigation stage. It's an agency. It's doing an investigation. There's no court, no further administrative oversight body until after a determination is made when it goes to the review board. I see my time has expired. So.
Yes, counsel, you'll have 3 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Why would the legislature use the word shall when it could use the word should or some other word when does shall mean shall?
Well, Your Honor, I think that really goes to the heart of what the issue is here. At its most fundamental level, this court is being asked to decide when the legislature uses language, do those words really matter or not? Does shall really mean shall? Or does it mean something else?
Well, but there's all kinds of case law that indicates it doesn't really mean shall. And particularly when you have a obligation imposed on a public official. So what makes this case different from that case law that says shall can be directory, not mandatory?
The answer, Your Honor, and what the state relies on is that Farmer's decision, which was a 95 case ruled by this court, in which the court said that when it comes to statutory construction, we have to determine legislative intent as a function of context. That context is based on a number of different factors. What the state is arguing that the absence or presence of a penalty when it comes to agency decision making is determinative and overrides all other factors.
And you're arguing the case law does not support that. So what in this case supports your position that shall is not mandatory?
Well, our position is that shall is mandatory.
Or is mandatory.
I mean, the fact that you have to do something within the set time doesn't necessarily include the consequence of failing to do so. You're saying automatically it means you have no authority to proceed further. Why does it mean that? Failing to comply with timelines and court proceedings may result in dismissal, may result in sanctions, may result in various different remedies. Why is the only remedy available here that you can't proceed at all as opposed to something lesser?
Well, because it's a function of the fundamental interest at stake here. And that is, we have seen in cases that have come before this court where the interest at stake is of such an importance that it can have a constitutional dimension. That it's that significant. This court is invariably...
But that's very different. And the briefs kind of mix these up. You're saying that this limit set in the statute necessarily defined due process. And what supports that argument?
Well,
because certainly, assuming there's a separate argument, there's no due process rights, or if there are, what those are. But why are those coincident with 30 and 90 days? The legislature doesn't get to decide due process. Courts do.
That's true. But in this case, Your Honor, at 210.145, our legislature said that as the purpose for these particular investigation statutes, there are balancing competing interests here. That is, protection of the children is an aim, but also to give protection to the due process rights of those who are accused of abuse and neglect.
Well, it's more than an aim. The legislature is trying to protect the children. When you're talking about a balance of interest, clearly this legislation was intended to protect the children. And now there's a balancing of interest between the timelines, et cetera, but the goal was to protect the children.
Well, that goes back
to... It wasn't just an aim, it was their goal.
Well, and the state wants to say this is a remedial statute and that it applies broadly with respect to all of 210, but I think the focus here is on the investigation framework as it applies to this
particular... Well, there's nothing that has to halt the investigation. The issue is whether or not somebody goes on the registry, right? I mean, you're not saying the investigation had to stop.
No.
You're just saying that the consequence of failure to do it timely is that the person doesn't go on the registry.
That's correct. And the purpose of the registry, Your Honor, is not to exonerate people. The purpose of the registry, as it was acknowledged in Jameson, is to be used as a tool for employment purposes when people perform background checks for those who are prospectively looking at participating in the care industry. So more immediate remedies available to address dangers presented to children other than listing in the registry. We have orders of child protection. We have the possibility of filing criminal charges that all provide more immediate relief than the registry does.
Counsel, let me back up to Judge Fisher's question. Because the relief you sought was not just to have her name off the registry, but was to have all evidence of the investigation purged from the division's files, correct?
You're right. That's what the relief is in terms of what statute provides.
So if Judge Fisher's hypothetical, they could have continued the investigation after the 90 days, but they would have had to destroy all the records and their conclusions. Is that your position?
There's nothing that keeps the agency, if you will, from continuing to investigate, but the form of process that is due is one of notice. Notice is a linchpin of due process. And what we're saying here is that we are entitled to notice, that it's couched in a mandatory effect.
If the decision had been made that it was a substantiated report on the second day, when is your client entitled to notice?
My client is entitled to notice on the 90th day, before the 90th day, on or before the 90th day. If they exceed, what the court held in Pettit was is that a agency only has such authority that has been expressly conferred by statute and no more. And when you write into these kinds of statutes, when it comes to notice or any other discretionary investigatory power exercised by the division, invariably what we have seen in Pettit, in Pitts, and in Jameson is that the overreaching of the exercise of that authority invariably comes at the expense of the accused. That is the context of judicial interpretation of these statutes.
So do we have to overrule Farmers and the dozens of other Court of Appeals cases that say that where there's no sanction set out for failing to follow timelines, they're directory?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because this case is consistent with those lines of cases been previously decided by this court, like State versus Tier, like Bauer, like the VJ contracting, where they all implicate important fundamental interests of the individual that take on a constitutional dimension.
But that's very different. Now you keep getting into the Constitution. The 90-day time limit is not a constitutional time limit. It's a statute.
It is statute, but there's nothing that prevents our statute from conferring more process than what the Constitution would minimally require.
But the there's no case that says the due process requires that if a time limit is set out in a statute, it must be interpreted as mandatory.
But I think that when you look at the time limit in terms of the other process that's afforded through the investigation,
Tell me why due process, I mean, if your argument is there was lack of due process, tell me why due process required it to be stopped when you didn't get the notice.
Before you do that, did you raise a due process claim in the trial
court?
No,
because, Your Honor, it wasn't essential to the ruling on this case of a mandatory versus directory reading. In our view, it's a function of context and looking at the considerations and what was compelling to the court in Frye was that it was you have to read these statutes harmoniously. And I think Judge Lynch, on behalf of the unanimous panel, provides very sound contextual arguments why to read this statute harmoniously at 152 in relation to 145, and the notice that the legislature expressly provides the language for in 183 to somebody like Melody, there could be no doubt that the conclusion is that the legislator intended that
that's a statutory interpretation, not a constitutional due process argument.
Correct, Judge. And I don't want to be misunderstood to saying that this court has to make a finding that someone's rights were violated by the state constitutionally, or that there was an infringement in order for the court to rule that the statute was mandatory. That's not our argument. My argument is that when the individual interest at stake rises and can take on a constitutional dimension such that the infringement of that would be an important interest, this court has, in Tier and in Bauer and in VJ Contracting, all implicated important rights, where the court said that in context of that, we would imply to the legislature the intent that the statute be strictly construed and that the terms be given their plain and ordinary meaning.
Why wouldn't we look at the effect of failure to comply with the statutory deadlines and decide whether it was prejudicial to your client? If so, that might then have serious due process implications.
Well,
but there's the day or few days here, there's no suggestion there was some reliance on that.
And really, your question, Your Honor, goes to what the state is advocating, which is let's look at this on a case-by-case basis, and if they exceed the time frame, let's weigh on the one hand the reasonableness of the infraction versus the prejudice to the individual. The problem with that is that now the court is interjecting itself in weighing the different competing policy objectives
where the legislature has not set out a consequence. Why isn't that the court's appropriate role?
Well, when the legislature used the word shall, it intended that it be used in its plain and ordinary meaning.
But it didn't say what the consequence of failing to comply with the shall was. You're saying in its implicit use of shall that if you don't comply with the time limit, you have no authority to proceed or the case has to be thrown out. And there are dozens and dozens of cases that say that's not the case. You look at the context. Sometimes that legislature says that, sometimes it doesn't.
But the legislature also said that in Tier and in Bauer, where we looked at in Bauer, and I think really the Southern District's approach is consistent with the teachings of Bauer, where in that case it involved the right of suffrage and putting a student bill of rights up for a vote. So we're talking about a fundamental interest at stake here.
Is that the basis of the Southern District's ruling? Because I may have misread their case, but my understanding of their ruling was you don't get to the concept discussed by Judge Stitt because the legislature made it clear in the language it used that it intended it to be mandatory. And so it merely is a statutory construction. You read it in context. You read these statutory provisions. You read them in context of the whole chapter. You don't get to what happens if we don't know what they intended. Therefore, you have to look at whether there are consequences or not. Was that what they did, and they didn't rely on the arguments that you're now making?
Right. I would agree with that. And I was there's nowhere in the Frey decision that talks about a constitutional issue whatsoever.
And so let's talk about what else there is in the statute, because they looked at the purposes of amendments that you focus clearly on what the intent of the legislature was from the language used and from the history of the statute. So how does that help you or not help you?
Well, I think it helps when you consider that whenever we have a rule of statutory construction that says whenever there is an amendment to an existing law, we have to presume that the legislature understood what the existing law was and that it affected or meant a change to that law. And so in 2005, which is the version of these statutes that were in effect, that involved Melody, there was no exception for a child fatality. There was no cause whatsoever to exceed the 90 days. Then on the heels of Jameson, the legislature revisited amending the statute, at which time it looked at the necessity of possibly a narrow exception for exceeding the 90-day requirement for a child fatality exception, and it passed that amendment And so that was persuasive evidence to the court in Fry that if there was already the ability to exceed the 90 days, as the state maintained, why would the legislature have passed the amendment in the first place?
But why doesn't that, I mean, clearly it says 90 days. You don't need the exception for a child death to show otherwise. The issue here is not, is there a 90-day limit, but what's the consequence of failing to meet it? And again, your argument, and I understand why, but your argument assumes that automatically, unless there's some reason otherwise, if you fail, you lose all authority at 90 days. And the legislature knows how to tell us that, and it failed to do so.
Well, it did tell us in the way of using shall, Your Honor. And I think the only way to enforce and require the agency to do its job, which, by the way, I would assert that protection of children is served by a timely investigation in which the agency is required to doggedly investigate those complaints to their conclusion.
And so what happens if they can't get information or if they're sent out for tests that aren't backed by the 90 days? They have to go on partial information? Well, and any later appeal would be based on this partial information? How does that benefit anybody, really?
I think that the legislature made a determination that any real threat of abuse or neglect can be detected by the agency before 90 days.
Well, let's go back to Judge Fisher's question, where he asked you about the language, whether it's mandatory or, I'll say, permissive. The question of... Judge Fisher's question about the language, whether she's entitled to a determination or the determination. Do you recall that question?
I do, Your Honor. I think it's not material to the resolution of the case because the fact is that she's entitled to a determination, a conclusion, and it specifies what that conclusion is. 210.183. Specifies what that has to be.
Why can't it be a preliminary determination?
Well, because I think that the legislature determined that people are prejudiced when we go beyond 90 days and there's more delay that goes on, and that there needs to be a determination at the 90-day mark. And there's only two options to be made here, Judge. Either it's substantiated or it's unsubstantiated. There's not a third option argued by the state, whereas at the 90-day mark, we need more time, and so we need, we're going to go beyond that 90 days as a third option. And that
Counsel,
was compelling to the court.
Why, if we agree with you that it's mandatory, then why wouldn't we hold that the result, the sanction then, is that it will be deemed to have found to be substantiated?
Well, because there has to be a factual basis for the investigation. That is a form of the process, and it's written into the statute. So to substantiate simply because they didn't complete their work within 90 days, I think would work a real prejudice to the...
Well, but you want a result that it's deemed to have been unsubstantiated.
No, what what we're asking is that if you don't completely do the job within 90 days, then the agency loses jurisdiction to act on the finding.
It's the first time you've used the word jurisdiction. You don't mean jurisdiction.
I don't.
Do
I mean authority, Your Honor. And that was conflated at the Southern District level. My time is up.
I wanted to ask you one more question.
Yes, Your Honor.
I wasn't really clear with your answer on how do you distinguish farmers from your position?
Well, because in farmers we don't have a statute that expressly acknowledges the due process rights that are important to an investigation subject like Melody. The request for a tax refund does not carry the same significance as it does here when someone's being investigated like Melody. That's one of the primary distinctions between farmers in this case. And really squares this case in line with that authority like Tier, Bauer, BJ Contracting, where those kinds of fundamental interests are at stake.
No further questions. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With regard to the cases, do the cases require, is the case law such that you can never find a statutory provision is mandatory without consequences being set out?
No.
So clearly, it is not essential that there be consequences set out in the statute for a court to interpret the statutory language to require that it be mandatory. And that's happened for the history decades.
I agree. But until the court below made its decision, every court that has construed statutes that impose a time limit on administrative decision making has construed them to be directory, not mandatory. Not just the Farmers Merchants Bank case, but the workers' compensation case, that's the Anchor Fence Company case, and the landfill permit case, the environmental safety case. In terms of sanctions, not putting the name on the registry is not a legislative sanction. That's a judicial sanction. There's no legislative sanction expressed anywhere in these statutes.
There doesn't have to be a legislative
it doesn't have
sanction.
To, but
that's
it,
my question.
Is, it doesn't have to be.
You have cases that have found any kind of public official deadlines mandatory simply from the language in the statute.
Well, there's the Bauer case where you have a drop dead deadline, specific date of significant importance, but there's nothing like that here. It's just an aspirational time limit on administrative decisions.
But in this situation, there are actual consequences if you put them in registry, and apparently, I'm sure his job prospects are gone, and also in any investigation, if you're going to if you know about the investigation, you can find the witnesses yourself and maybe defend yourself better. If you know, if the investigation goes on for a year without any notice, whatever witnesses you may have been able to find in your own defense might have disappeared. So there are definite consequences. Although, as good Judge Wilson mentioned, the due process, the constitutional issue needs to be raised if you're going to raise it before us.
Well,
a tax issue is different from a possible criminal investigation.
We should be clear that the name does not go on the registry as a result of the investigation. It only goes on the registry after the Children's Division proves abuse and neglect before the hearing board. The investigation does not result in any sanction until there's proof before an administrative agency.
And the standard set by the statute that you've argued to us, the legislature could not have intended that there be a mandatory time period. The standard is probable cause, that the legislature, that the Children's Division doesn't have to have completed its investigation and made a final determination. They only,
That's not the standard.
Isn't? Am I looking at the wrong statute?
The statute says that the division must make a determination by preponderance of the evidence, which is the same standard it must prove before the hearing review board.
I'm looking at a statute that was attached to one of the briefs and said the notice shall advise either that the division has determined by a probable cause finding. Oh, it's after the date. Okay.
Yes.
So it is preponderance of the evidence.
Are you limited to the... I'm sorry, go ahead. Are you limited to preponderance of the evidence? And
yes.
Are you limited to the record made during that investigation at the subsequent hearing, or can there be additional investigation?
I would think not, that the division is not limited.
Okay.
As a practical matter, it probably is, however.
Do you have any questions?
One question. Do you have 210-145 in front of you? I'm sure you don't. I'll just tell you. The section I'm looking at is 13. That allows the division to terminate an investigation prior to a determination, and to opt then for the assessment services route.
Right.
Are you aware of any other provision other than that one in this entire 50 pages of statutes that contemplates an investigation beginning and not resulting in a determination?
No.
The statutes that deal with what gets released and to whom and when and under what circumstances. Those are separated only into, you know, every investigation is either determined to be substantiated or determined not to be substantiated.
That's where you get to at the end, whether it takes 30, 90, or more days. Any determination language is linked to the 90 days, but because it says any determination, that means a determination that has been made, and that makes going beyond the 90 days, the directory construction consistent with the statutory language. In addition to our remedial purpose, the statutory language, and the intent of the legislature argument, there's the argument that if these timelines are mandatory, it does not promote reasoned decisions. It promotes arbitrary decisions one way or the other for no reason, just because a decision has to be made. That does not promote good decision making.
So we're supposed to be giving meaning to the words of the legislature. Couldn't they have just said should instead of shall?
Would not help us. Would not help us, because the courts have construed should, shall, will, depending on the context. And here, the overriding context of the remedial purpose of these statutes, it should be construed in favor of the child so long as it's consistent with the statutory language. And it is here with the two words in the determination. See, my time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
Ask the judgment be reversed.
Thank you. The matter will be taken under advisement.